The Fancy Film Fellows employs a frank discussion of cinema that includes adult language and descriptions of mature situations. We have no concern for spoilers, so be warned, you might learn more than you'd care to know.
À une heure pareille. Dieu, vous avez du sang partout.
Pardon.
De quoi me demandez-vous pardon?
D'être une bête. Pardon.
Revisitation rights.
Hey everybody, it's another Fancy Film Fellows podcast coming at you, and we are really getting into another is this a new format? Have we done...
This is our first of this format, but continuing this month's theme.
Yeah, we're still talking about auteurs, but this time we are revisiting some auteurs that we maybe didn't care for in the past, and we're giving them another look, and we're gonna see if our minds have changed a little bit since the last time that we saw these movies. So we're gonna be talking about three movies today. Unfortunately, Basil is not with us, but I am joined by Ruben.
Hi, and the name of the podcast is Revisitation.
Oh yeah, right? Because we're revisiting them. Mm-hmm. Yes, and Ilya's also with us.
Hello.
Back again.
Yes.
All right. The three movies that we're going to be talking about today are La Belle et la Bête, otherwise known as Beauty and the Beast, from 1946, directed by Jean Cocteau. Le Samurai, from 1967, directed by Jean-Pierre Melville. And Southland Tales, from 2006, directed by Richard Kelly. And we're going to go in chronological order. So we're going to start with Ruben's pick, which was La Belle et la Bête. And Ruben, take it away.
Thank you, Patrick. So the reason why I chose this movie, like, I think probably it would make sense for me to choose a David Lynch movie, because I watched Twin Peaks Firewalk with me and I really liked it this year. So I definitely feel like his films are probably worth revisiting. But I think my story for, like, why I didn't like this film when I was younger is already sort of, like, revealing of how much context shapes your opinions on things. Mm. And since that's sort of, like, the name of the game with this, and is that all there is to my childhood, I figured, like, it was a good pick. And that's basically that. So, like, I saw this movie in French class, because, you know, middle school and high school teachers love to put on a film for a lot of reasons. It gives them a chance to take a break from lesson planning. Kids often think it's cool to watch a movie. They're like, ooh, no class, just a movie.
They sure do.
But, you know, they might be hungover from the night before, so they don't want anyone to know. They can just sit in the back of the class.
That's why teachers show movies?
Yes.
All day.
It's not the only reason, but it's one reason. The first time I saw this, I think it was pre-Usual Suspects, which longtime listeners may remember. It is like the turning point for me as a movie guy. So I was like, I don't really care about movies, and this movie is old and in French. So I was just like, whatever about it. But then a couple years later, another French teacher showed it in a different French class. And I was like, I don't want to see this movie again. At this point, I did like movies. But I was like, I've already seen this movie in the past couple years, and I didn't really care about it. Then I got to college, and my intro to film class showed it again. So now I've seen it 3 times in 4 years. And then I took a French film class and they showed it again.
Jesus.
And like, it was, you know, who knows really how I felt about it on the first watch, but by the fourth watch, I was like, I can't escape this movie.
It is stalking you.
Yeah, and I was like, and I don't want to see it anymore. And now I hate it because of that. I mean, it's also a corny movie, and, you know, I definitely didn't want to be corny back then. I wanted to be cool. Yeah, I'm excited to say that I rewatched it, and then I rewatched it again last week in preparation for this podcast. And I've found the 1940s Twilight, which is exciting. I love Twilight. And that's what this movie is. I would say probably my major complaint about it is that all the actors are too old, because it's a very violent teen style romance in a lot of ways. That's, you know, all about sort of like the untamable magic of feelings and how they just like override your senses in a lot of ways, and literally has like scenes of the beast hunting deer and eating them, just like Twilight, which makes me think that Hardwick is even influenced by this movie, the fact that she chose deer to be what the vampires eat in
Interesting.
The movie.
Nice.
My favorite scene is probably a part when Belle stumbles upon the beast just drinking from a pond in the middle of this forest outside of his castle. And like, you can tell that she's both disgusted and turned on by it. And I'm like, that must be what it's like to be attracted to cis men at all times.
Lord, yes.
And yeah, the things that people say about it are definitely true. The sets are like pretty amazing. It just goes to show that like, when you put in a lot of effort and consider like the level of, you know, whatever, I guess, technological achievement that you have in the moment, that you create something that is timeless, I guess, in its look, even if like we know how things work in order to do it. So like, there's a scene where Belle's father is sick, and the beast gives her a magic glove that allows her to travel to anywhere that she wants. We've got our own Belle and the Beast situation going on here in the apartment with the cats chasing each other.
Right now it's just Indy chasing herself.
And the way that they do the effect is like, it looks like she puts on the glove and like sinks into the bed and then comes out of like her wall in her like room. And you can tell that they like shot it backwards, like that they kind of like pulled her, they used like ropes or something to pull her up the wall and then like threw it and then just reversed the footage. But they did such a good job. It's such like a surprising moment, and you're like, whoa. At least I was like, wow, that's pretty intense effects work for 1946. For this, really just this one moment to look cool. Belle's room at the Beast Castle is like, it exists both inside and outside at the same time. Like, there's like a tree in it and just like moss growing across the floor. And I'm like, this is awesome. I love just looking at this. Yeah, I think it has a lot of the problems that all Beauty and the Beast adaptations have.
It's a kind of a story about Stockholm Syndrome.
Stockholm Syndrome isn't a real thing, but yeah. The idea of like, yeah, falling in love with your abuser and changing him for the better.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of baked into the story, I guess.
Yep.
It's hard to change that key element.
Yeah, I mean, the only way that you could make it the same story and, you know, have something to say about that would be to make it, like, dark, make it a critique. She ends up with the beast at the end, but we're sad. We're like, oh, that actually should not have happened.
Yeah, I want to refer the famous story. I can't remember which actress it was, but when she saw the movie, she was very disappointed that the beast turned into a human at the end.
Yeah. At the premiere at somewhere, Cannes or Telluride or something like that, she was like, oh no, where has my beautiful beast gone?
I think it was Marlene Dietrich, if I'm, I might be mistaken on that, but I think that
well,
it was her.
As we know from Blonde Venus, she likes, she's maybe was a furry, or at least she likes emerging from costumes.
I wouldn't presume to put Marlene Dietrich's sexuality into a box. She seemed like she had it all going on, honestly.
Absolutely.
I understand what she's saying, though. This, the beast costume is, like, weirdly impressive. I don't know how they did his eyes, because, like, he has furry eyelids. And I'm like, did they glue fur to the actor's eyes? Because he's, like, blinking with, like, fur. So, like, it disappears up under his, you know, bone structure or whatever up there. And then maybe the mask is, like, slightly bigger than his actual face. And then
maybe I wouldn't put it past them in those days, though. They did, you know, in 1939, cover a man in lead paint and then wonder why he broke out because of it. So yeah. The Wizard of Oz did a lot of stuff like that. It was like, yeah, let's just put horrible chemicals on people's skin and just, you know, ride with it.
I guess that's all I have to say about La Belle et la Bête.
Would you show it at a film class that you would teach?
I bet each individual teacher thought, I'm about to blow these kids' minds. Oh Lord. All right. Well, I guess we'll move to my pick, since we're going in chronological order, to the 60s, to 1967's Le Samurai.
Le Samurai.
Le Samurai.
Masculine.
Yes. Le Samurai. Not La Samurai. Le Samurai. Yeah. And the reason that I wanted to revisit this movie is because I think it's the only movie that I've given a half a star to that seems to be beloved by a lot of people in the film community. I think Melville in general is sort of considered one of the, like, key auteurs of, you know, French New Wave, and, you know, in real life was actually I think, like, one of the, like, French underground working against the Nazis too, so he had, like, real life cred too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I
would, that were me, I would love to only have seen one film that I gave a half star to that is beloved.
Yeah, I'm not as contrarian as most people, and because of that, I think I was like, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I'm not giving this movie a fair shake, because the first time I saw it, I was just extremely bored by it, and I don't think that anything ruined a film more for me than being bored at the time. But now I've seen some movies that I was bored by and still enjoyed them, so I, you know, gave it another look, because I want to say at the time that I saw this, my favorite movies were like, probably like Coen Brothers movies or stuff that was like more on the sort of mainstream commercial spectrum, where it was like I was very indebted to the, you know, three act Western canon of storytelling and whatnot. And so I was like not prepared for how much this movie just like sort of makes you sit and watch someone in a room or someone doing something mundane. And so I was like, maybe I was too hard on it. So that was really why I wanted to revisit it, just because I felt like I didn't give it a fair shake. But I guess I'll go through the plot on this one too, or Or
we don't have to.
We don't have to go through the plot. Yeah.
You just say what you thought of it this time on rewatch.
This time on rewatch, I do think that there are some aspects of it that I didn't pick up on before. Maybe I wasn't even prepared to pick up on before. Mostly about how the cops are just dirt bags, which I liked. Yeah. I liked that the cops were sleazy, and I was like, okay, this part I'm into. Like, I could get behind a movie that was about how, you know, cops are scumballs, but the rest of it, I'm still just not interested in it. Like, I'm not interested in Jeff Costello as a character. I don't, you know, Alain Delon looks great in a hat and a suit, but
he sure does.
I am not interested in this character at all. And I'm also not interested in the scenes that Melville chooses to draw out for long periods of time, like the guys going through his apartment and placing the bug, or him like sitting there bandaging himself while dramatic music
so funny to me.
Dramatic music plays, and I was like, why is dramatic music playing over him bandaging himself? I don't understand this. There are just a lot of baffling choices, especially just logically in the movie. Like, the way that people pick locks in this movie is they just have a ring of a million keys and just go through all of them. And I was like, that cannot be the way that lock picking works. Or you know, stealing a car, where he just gets into an unlocked car and then just pulls out a ring of a million keys and just goes through them one by one until one of them starts the car. I was like, that's... No.
What if the car was locked? Like, would he have to go through all the keys?
That's what I was thinking. I was like, do people just not lock their cars in Paris? Where everyone else is seemingly carrying a gun because they're too afraid to walk around the streets? Like, that's a detail we learned later. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. So there's a lot of weird logic gaps in this movie. And I also think some of it tries to ratchet up tension in places where I like specifically like don't understand where the tension is supposed to be coming from, because it wants us to be more invested in characters that we've literally learned nothing about to this point. And I don't know, I guess that could be kind of an interesting exercise if that's all the film was, but then it kind of becomes more conventional as it goes along, where it's like, oh, now we're going to learn a little bit and, you know, maybe have like some stakes in this movie that are more conventional. But again, I'm like, I don't really care if the police catch Jeff Costello, because I don't know, like, who is he? What does he stand for? Like, he's murdered a man, and that's about all I know about him. And I'm like, it's probably fine if they catch him, since he has murdered someone. And I mean, I don't know. That's the thing, is like, I wish it gave me a more clearly defined, like, if nothing else, like, social stratum, the way it does in the scenes with his, he calls her his fiance, but, you know, his love interest, I guess, or one of his love interests.
Played by Delon's wife.
Yeah, and I was like, I like this scene because I understand the dynamic here. Like, I understand the socioeconomic dynamic, and I also understand the power dynamic between this woman and this cop. And I'm like, okay, like, you've given me a clear set of, you know, boundaries here, and I understand where the game's being played. And the other ones, I'm just like, well, I don't know if I like Jeff Costello, so I don't know if I care if the police catch him or not. And, you know, a lot of the movie does that for me. It's like, it wants to drop me in there and say, like, this guy looks cool, so you should be on his side. And I'm like, that's not my criteria for liking someone.
I watched all the films for this. And I mean, this is more about, like, the difference or the similarity between Patrick's past opinion and his current opinion. But, like, I didn't think the film was like, you should like Jeff Costello. I think it was more like, how long will you be invested in a character that you know literally nothing about just because he's the first person on screen. Like, how long is this movie's sort of like empty Bressonian action going to be cool? And at what point are you like, films are stupid? Like,
I mean, I guess if I felt like the movie was invested in that idea, but it doesn't seem like it is up to the end, because it wants to give you that sort of, I mean, the ending is clearly like one of those like release moments where it's like, it was a twist. Like, you thought he was going to be a bad guy, but he was really a good guy the whole time. But even then, like, I don't understand his motivation in that moment too, because I'm like, yeah, I know he likes the piano player that he pretends he's going to shoot, but I don't really understand why he gets himself shot.
Yeah, that's all. It's very, very convoluted. I mean, it's funny. Like, that movie, I have sort of a personal history with. Like, it was the first movie I consciously watched off of Roger Ebert's great movies list.
Yeah, this is the second time Le Samurai has come up on our podcast.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I think I haven't rewatched it in a long time. I think it was, like, for me as like a 16, 17-year-old, exactly the movie I really wanted to watch and like live in, because it was like sexy and Delon looked great, and like you could pretty much imprint yourself on the character as a 16, 17-year-old or whatever guy. It's very about masculinity and how cool it is to be like this isolated killer guy.
yeah.
And I think a lot of that is pretty fucking silly, probably, like looking at it afterwards.
That was something that I noticed a lot more this time around. I was like, man, if I had seen this movie when I was a teenager, like, I would have been all about this. I'd have been like, yeah, this guy's fucking cool. He's like a killer. He's like stone cold. You know, he looks great in a suit. I would be like, that's exactly who I want to be. Mm. It's that person. And, like, I think it's because I saw it when I was a little bit older that I was kind of like, I guess I had seen other things that I was more impressed with. And I was like, I don't get the big fusses about this movie, and I really want to dislike it. But seeing it now, too, I'm like, I don't like that kind of character anymore. Like, I don't care about a person who's like a stone cold killer and is like super cool all the time. And there are even lines in this movie that sound like they're trying to be kind of like tough guy cool, but they just come off really flat to me, and I'm just like, that sounds like they could have workshopped that line a little bit better. Like, it does it sounds like a first draft, and they could have punched it up at some point, because it doesn't really sound that cool. There's one part where he's like, I never lose, mostly, or something like that. Like, he's just like,
cool.
Yeah, it's like, I definitely recommend you don't watch Bresson then. Well, that's the style was very similar. If I had to guess, I would guess instead of it being a first take, it's actually a thousandth take, and this is all exhaustion that you're watching. It's like people,
maybe. but like, I've seen Bresson films, and I like Bresson's films. Oh, yeah? I
get Patrick's point, though. I support that, because I remember watching that scene where he like takes the gun away from that other guy, right, in his apartment. And it's like supposed to be like cool, he gets one over on him, but yeah, the line delivery is really weird, and there's a lot about this that feels like, yeah, he wants to be like a Dashiell Hammett character or whatever, or like this cool noir dude, and it's instead just kind of clumsy. Like, I remember feeling that way pretty strongly, but I think, you know, Maybe my impression would change now that I have seen some Bresson films. Back then, I hadn't. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing with Bresson's films too. Like, to jump over to that real quick, like, his protagonists don't feel cool to me. They feel kind of pathetic in a way.
Like, the donkey's pretty cool.
Well, I was gonna say, but even him, like, he's very pitiable. Like, Balthazar is, he's a pitiable character, and, you know, A Gentle Woman, which we watched for the podcast. Yeah, yeah. Like, the protagonist in that is definitely, like, he's very pathetic, and he's trying to sort of mythologize his own backstory throughout the entire movie. And I really liked that about his films, the Bresson films that I've seen. I'm like, yeah, Bresson kind of gets how pitiable these characters are, and it doesn't seem like Melville does. Mm. Like, Melville doesn't really understand how sad a character that Jeff Costello really is. And I think that's what bothers me about the movie, is that he sort of, I don't know, he seems like someone who probably, like, read some Philip Marlowe stories and, like, yeah, Philip Marlowe is really cool. Whereas, like, I listen to them now and I'm like, Philip Marlowe seems really sad and confused. You know, every Raymond Chandler story I listen to, I'm like, man, he seems like he's not having a good time ever. Like, he seems like he's always having bad times.
I do disagree. I don't think that the movie, you're supposed to think he's super cool. I guess, and if you want to watch a more straightforward and, in my opinion, better version of a similar plot, I think This Gun for Hire is a really, really good movie about a gun for hire who gets betrayed and then just becomes so obsessed with revenge that he's willing to abandon every other part of his life in order to follow through on it.
Cool.
This Gun for Hire.
I also wanted to point out quickly the kind of exotification of the, I guess you would call her the femme fatale character, the piano player, though, because it's like, ooh, we have a black lady in the movie. We're going to make her, like, walk around her house in a kimono for some reason.
Very weird.
I was
weird.
A little confused, and all the decor in her apartment, I was like, something's up here. But, yeah, it's not super, like, explicit, but it definitely has tinges of, like, yeah, we're going to exotify her. She's like a sexy black lady who plays the piano. And I was like, okay, all right. Chill out.
Right on. So,
all right, on to you, Ilya.
Yeah, so the reason I wanted to revisit Southland Tales is because back, I don't know, when I watched it, this was like 2005, 2006, I guess, or something. 2006 was when the movie came out, so it must have been like the year after that, so 2007. I watched it having, you know,
I remember you worked for like a festival once or something. I thought maybe you saw it the year before I came.
At the Munich Film
so
Fest.
I wasn't gonna correct you.
That would have been fun. I mean, considering the fact that this movie was infamously booed at the Cannes Film Festival, I don't think Richard Kelly wanted to send it to any other European festival after that. So, I watched it, and I was not a big fan of Donnie Darko, and I think at the time, you know, this was like in the heyday of like film rating communities and stuff like that. People like Richard Kelly or people like who liked Donnie Darko were like, you know, boring normies and whatever, and I definitely didn't want to be that. And then when I watched this movie, I was basically, I'd said, I'm going to hate this, and I did. And I now, the reason why I wanted to revisit it is because I thought, oh, a big sprawling mess of a movie with Sarah Michelle Gellar in it, in a prominent role playing a porn star, and some other stuff that sounded vaguely like poppy and fun. Sure, why not? Give it another.
It's had some critical reappraisal. As
it
well.
Sure has. If you look at
5 years,
if you look at. Both like general critical reappraisal and like Letterboxd, like it's also incredibly polarizing to this day. Like people either give it 5 stars or like 1 star most of the time. I'm just gonna go ahead and say that I'm firmly in the 1 star side. So I mean, it would be interesting to like this movie, and I've read some appraisals of it that almost make me convinced that maybe I'm missing something.
I don't think you meant it to be, but that was like a really cruel thing to
say. I know.
Because it makes me seem cooler.
Yeah, it's like, because I feel like what is thrown together here, much like, I don't know, it seems like a guy, like someone who has read a lot of things and watched a lot of things and thinks that that makes him know about a lot of, you know, world's, like, life stuff, and he can, like, create this ambitious project, and because he had a successful movie, they gave him a lot of money to do this. They gave him, apparently, his choice of actors and actresses. The movie is stacked from, like, in terms of the casting. And this has, there was obviously a lot of money then afterwards put into special effects and whatever. There's a lot of, like, they gave him a lot of freedom here to do whatever he wanted. And the problem when you do that with someone who doesn't really have a clear vision of what he wants is that the result will be a huge mess, which isn't even particularly interesting, like, to me. I think that there's, like, I don't know, there's just, like, all this very bland kind of discourse about vaguely Marxism, I guess. There's a group called the Neo-Marxists, right, who are, like,
yep,
cool power girls who, like, blow shit up or whatever, and, like, they don't have any, like, coherent ideology or any coherent message, or what exactly they are fighting is never quite clear. It's all very, like, fight the system and, like, let's create chaos and whatever. And it's just, I don't know, it's very, like, I went to, you know, college and I know about Marx, like, that sort of thing. It's just a lot of very condescending, like, it felt very condescending a lot of the times. And in a way, even this light of ideological mess that it creates led me to keep thinking throughout that, like, oh, Richard Kelly's just one of those guys who thinks that, oh, the discourse is too toxic, and if all, yeah, we all just came together and found the third way.
Big centrist energy.
Oh, Lord.
It's like,
yeah. Third way.
Yeah. Way, I mean, literally, yeah, the relationship between The Rock's character and Sarah Michelle Gellar's character is, like, completely hinged on this idea, because he's, like,
yeah,
what, the son of, like, essentially the Republican.
He's the husband of that, of, a, yeah, of the daughter of this Republican guy.
Yeah, this Republican, yeah, family, but he's, like, with, yeah, Sarah Michelle Gellar, who's, like, a porn star and a TV reality star and, like,
yeah,
this, you know, pseudo-leftist type thing, and he has amnesia, and it's, like, this weird relationship. It's supposed to be some sort of, like, political comment or something about,
yeah, it. Yeah, I don't see that, and this is exactly, like, I don't think this movie really has a lot to say politically. I think Richard Kelly thinks, sure, he has a lot to say, and I really don't think the movie has a lot to say. But people certainly see a lot of stuff in this, and I'm very, like, okay, that's cool, obviously, it's, like, subjective. I'm not saying that they shouldn't look for things inside, but I really was, I would have liked to have more fun watching a 2.5 hour movie that was supposed to kind of be fun, I think, at some point, and instead is just this weird mess, and, like, just, it hides a lot behind, like, these confusing, like, abstract whatever dialogue and whatever, and then ends up telling a pretty basic story in the end. Like, there's not that much, I feel, to untangle in what is, like, what lies underneath a lot of this, a lot of the stuff that this movie's talking about. I thought this, like, I also thought the movie's really dated, because, yeah, there's so much, like, Bush and whatever stuff, like, and reality TV is gonna be, it's gonna ruin everything, and these people will, like, control the world. I mean, yeah, but also that there's, like, the way that that goes into that, it doesn't really go beyond this, like, disgust for certain things. And I also think, you know, there's one way of casting people like Sarah Michelle Gellar and The Rock. If you, no, it's so clear that the casting was, like, a decision, because the idea of Sarah Michelle Gellar or the idea of The Rock appealed to Kelly. But it wasn't it seems like a pretty very basic understanding of who they were or why they were might maybe misunderstood as, you know, personalities or personas. Like, you know, if you really liked Sarah Michelle Gellar in Buffy, for example, like, play to her strengths. Why make her play this weird, like, you know, kind of plasticky porn star who keeps talking about, you know, chugging cocks and stuff like that? I don't know. Like, I feel like you're underselling the person that you're actually trying to, like, give a real shot at, a, like, being in a, like, a cool movie. I think that male direct. I think that's like the Tarantino thing, like, where you want to cast people who, you know, give them like a, give their career a second chance. But I feel like a lot of that is, I don't know, is due to misunderstanding what these people are really good at and the desire to, like, own them in a weird way. So yeah, and I, again, so there's not actually that much more that I even want to talk about right now. If you guys have something about
I thought some of the dancing in that, like, yeah, final rally was, like, okay, but until that point I was, like, so disinterested in this movie that I was having trouble even sort of keeping one eye on the screen. I watch most movies these days with my phone in front of me, and usually it's more like I'm kind of looking at the screen and then, like, I glance down at my phone, but this, I just, like, had my phone, like, covering half the screen and was, like, sort of, like, every once in a while. It definitely also confirmed that, like, Justin Timberlake is, like, a really bad actor. Just, like, unnervingly bad. Like, The Rock and Sarah Michelle Gellar, I think, give bad performances. But even if this was the only thing that I'd seen them in, I would be like, yeah, kind of the direction is weird or something. Like, I could believe that they could give a good performance. But Justin Timberlake is miscast and just not good.
Yeah.
IMO. And yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said, so I don't really have, like, a super response to it. It's a big, messy film, but not messy in the way in which the person feels unsure of their conclusions, where they're, like, trying to enter, like, spaces that they know they don't have, like, real answers for. It's, like, messy because it thinks that that's smart. Like, being messy is, you know, a good way to, like, make a film. And it's like, what if we, you know, we're going to just put, like, some of everything in here? And it's like, but you don't have anything to say about any of these things, nor do you feel, like, truly exploratory about it. It's like, you're very confused, but feel very arrogant about that confusion. You know, I...
Totally. And I mean, I don't mean to dismiss, you know, what I, maybe what I said earlier was a bit much.
I liked it.
But, I mean, sometimes that's... I say something sucks, and that doesn't mean that other people can't like it. But that said, I do think it sucks, so that's it.
It's always fair.
Same boat.
Yeah. All right.
It's the worst movie that I watched last month.
Nice.
Yeah, and the soundtrack is also really boring. I thought, like, people gave Moby, like, a lot of credit for it. I mean, the themes or whatever, the theme music is okay-ish, but the soundtrack is all, like, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club and, like, The Killers and, like, all stuff that, like, you know, normies in 2006 thought was cool.
It's songs that Joseph Kahn put over the little, like, montage that he does in Detention, where he's, like, showing, like, the various, like, mid-aughts music movements.
Yes.
And he's using them because it's so on the nose that it's goofy. And here they're like, yeah, no, this is the real shit.
I need to watch Detention again. I think I'll like it better this time.
Yeah. Imagine this movie, but directed by Joseph Kahn.
I mean, in general, anytime that someone makes a satire, I'm like, I wish Verhoeven or Roth or Dante or Kahn had directed it.
And so, yeah.
Like, someone with who is, like, admits that they're an embarrassing person and sort of, like, drives forward into that, like, uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want the man who directed the video for the thong song to make my satire, guys.
Yeah, I mean,
the man who understands.
I think that, like, putting, what this movie does is, like, putting Hustler on a tank, you know, like as if Hustler is deep. Sponsoring the tank. I mean, I guess you could call that satire, but you could also call it, like, a dumb joke, like, that doesn't really work very well, and yeah. That's that. And somebody might have just advised Richard Kelly to be like, listen, why don't you just spend a little more time on this fucking script and make something a bit more clear? I don't know. But instead, you know, that's what happens, I feel like, when, I mean, young dudes get too successful too early.
Not anymore.
All men are canceled.
All right.
Yeah. I had, like, literally just watched this movie. It's not... commentary about that movie, but like it was like I was watching it and then Richard Kelly came up on my Twitter feed. Someone was like, what happened to Richard Kelly? Why isn't he directing movies anymore? And I could tell they were earnestly interested in his career, so I didn't respond, but I wanted to be like the first person who actually wasn't allowed to continue to make movies because his movies were bad. Most people's movies are bad get to keep making them forever. But it's like, this is the one good decision Hollywood's ever made. Why do you want them to go back on it?
Him and Troy Duffy, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did write a bunch of like graphic novels and stuff about...
They tried to give Troy Duffy a second chance, but he was too misogynist and unnerving for even Hollywood to accept.
Yeah. Pretty impressive.
He was too much of a shithead for Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
Just saying something.
He was like, man, you gotta keep this stuff in private.
Oh, Lord.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Can't wait to end of the podcast. Hesitation, right?
Got him.
Got him.
We did it big this time, guys.
Okay. You should wrap us up.
Yep. All right. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this, you can check us out at fancyfilmfellows.com, or you can find us on pretty much any podcast aggregating service, Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, or the one I use is called Podcast Addict. So that's true. I am a podcast addict. You can also find us on Spotify and... yeah, what's next for us? What's coming up?
Film Flam.
Film Flam. We're gonna do trivia.
Yeah.
All right.
If you want,
if you want to hear us answer questions,
Basil will be hosting, and it will once again be auteur themed.
All right.
Yeah. If you want to hear us answer questions, or if you want to get mad at us for not knowing the answers to questions, you should check us out next time. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Nailed it.
Yay.